Hello, good morning. You're very welcome to the programme. Between now and nine, a fire in a hole in a bog in the Midlands, the infrared eye in the sky in Roscommon, something low, something higher in Wicklow, endangered cows in Mayo, and the sweet smell of longed-for rain countrywide. There is, of course, absolutely no accounting for what the weather is going to do, and while it does look like there's a wet week ahead, many are worried that summer 2025 is going to be the exact opposite of summer 2024. Long, hot and dry. If so, our contacts in the Forest Service tell us that we are on course for a record-breaking wildfire season in Ireland. Yes, a record-breaking wildfire season in Ireland. You heard me right. Roscommon fire crews don't need to be told this. They found themselves pulled in the opposite directions of four different bog and forest fires simultaneously this week. Livestock and homes were evacuated, thousands of acres of forestry and special areas of conservation were destroyed. I wanted to see how hard it was to put out a fire when it gets down into dried out peat bog, as it did this week. So I met with an expert on the topic, firefighter Anthony Tynan in Laois, who brought me to the scene of a recent bog fire, started by fly tippers, but exaggerated by the dry weather. That is crunchy, dry material, isn't it? It wouldn't take much to set that off.
Absolutely not. That's very, very dry fuel.
And that's everywhere in this landscape.
Absolutely.
After, what are we looking at now, 4 or 5 weeks without proper rain?
Without exactly, yeah. We had a wet weekend, but we haven't had that much rain over the month. And then we have these other fuels. So we take that surface dead fuel, we bring it up into these shrubs, bushes, and up into the trees and into the larger trees. That's when you get your really serious fires, when the fire spreads from the ground up into trees.
What is the difference between a fire on a bog and a fire in a bog?
Absolutely. So on a bog, it's surface fuels. Look around there, you can see all the light fuels, the gorse, the light grasses, shrubs. Down in the bog itself is peat. Depending on time of year, that's drier or wetter, but as it gets dry, it becomes obviously a fuel in its own right, which is why people harvest it. And that can burn for days, weeks, months, if it's left uncontrolled.
Raised bogs like this can run metres deep, 4, 8, 10 metres deep. How deep can the fire go?
Oh, it can go down deep enough that if you fall into it, you'll get hurt. Like, you can have areas of bog, if it burns down, where you literally have person-sized holes you can fall into. The bogs we have here have been typically drained over the years for harvesting purposes, so they're quite dry. But you'll definitely burn down a metre, 2 metres, no problem.
So what's the commitment of resources then when a fire gets into a bog? How many days will you have to spend looking at that?
Yeah, it's one of the situations where it becomes more of a machinery problem than a water problem. So you have to dig. You need to bring in heavy machinery and dig out the burning peat. It can go on for ages. You can think the fire's out, you come back, you know, a week later it's popped up again somewhere. So it becomes like a long-term fire. In 2018, the fires were, they were burning for, like, they could go out, and then 2 weeks later you go back to the same site where the fire had restarted. You need to do really, really intense mop-up of these fires to go back, even when you think it's out, and make sure it's actually out.
So when you have had a really, really wet year like we had last year, with presumably also growth after it, and then we have a long dry spell now, and if we're to have another summer like 2018, is that an Irish Midlands firefighter's perfect storm?
It can be, absolutely. So we have the sort of traditional fire season people think of, which is sort of April into May, which is when surface fuels burn off. But when you get those hot summers, you get really dry soil, the heavier fuels dry out, you can get some intense situations. We saw that last year in 2018, when we had very large fires across the area. And that's when you can get the particularly damaging fires as well, where it burns well down into the ground.
So what happened here?
Yeah, so there was basically illegal dumping here. I suppose in the interest of not having the stuff identified afterwards, someone set fire to it. So we got a call to bog on fire, a couple of calls for it. Luckily it hadn't spread too far, it was early in the season. And crews then spent a good few hours just mopping up, tidying up the fire. We had it sort of under control by nightfall. Then they came back the next morning just to mop up and make sure it was out, which is the key issue in peat fires. You don't want the fire burning down into the ground.
Looking at all this turf laid out here, I remember when I was a lad, there used to be a practice of burning off areas for ground spread, for drying turf. Does that still happen?
It seems to be less prevalent than it was. Absolutely, if the fire gets out of the area it was meant to stay in and spreads into an adjacent area, absolutely, that can be a risk. Okay. But it seems to be less prevalent. Fires can also spread in from outer areas, like say if a bonfire in someone's garden can jump into an area, which I've seen happen recently as well. Mm. Recreational, say for example, scrambler bikes cause sparks during the dry weather can cause fires to start.
What impact then have the policy changes had on the fire landscape, if you like? Things like rewetting, I would have thought would have made the landscape safer, but rewetting implies more vegetation growth.
Yep, you'll have more surface fuels, surface fires, less underground fires, hopefully, with rewetting. Also, the access pattern changes. Less people are coming into the bog for various activities, so that can have an effect. There's nothing that'll make fires stop effectively. Fires will always happen, but hopefully rewetting, they'll be less inclined to burn down into the peat.
Do we either choose to manage the landscape differently as it changes, as climate change impacts and so on, or do we choose to resource you guys with more machinery to fight bigger fires?
It's a balance. The solution won't be firefighting. We have to work on the landscape first because that's the main thing. But then we also have to make sure that when fires happen, as they will, we can't stop fires happening completely, that we are adequately resourced to tackle them.
But it's an interesting old conversation, isn't it? It depends on what hat you put on when you look at a landscape as to what way you manage it. Do you manage it for ecology? Do you manage it for infrastructure like that wind farm? Or do you manage it to ensure that when the wildfires happen that they're small and can be put out easily?
The trick is to find the safe balance.
And no right answers here. It's a balance of interests.
Absolutely. And like we can't have a situation where we've got small parcels of land that are just managed purely for fire reasons. We have to have livable land and sustainable ecological systems as well.
Anthony Tynan there. Now, it is nesting time for curlews in areas like that bog in Laois and the ones that were devastated in Roscommon. Clodagh Helen was conducting a survey of curlew nesting sites on Monday night as one of those fires took hold.
So the time we were out there, we were actually working on a project between ourselves, the Hen Harrier Programme, and the Breeding Wader EIP. So we have some drones that we use to search for curlew nests specifically. The drones, they have a thermal imaging camera on it as well as a zoom camera. So if we think there's curlew activity in an area, we're called in, then the nest protection officers will call us in to try and search and find the nest so we can try and find it quickly and efficiently. So that's what we were doing. We were out maybe 4:30 a.m. on Monday morning as early as possible. So it was good conditions for the drone to pick up the heat signal from the nest. And then we pass on that information to the staff and the Breeding Wader EIP. And the decision then is really in their hands. In some cases, if the risk of predation is low, they might put up a predator-proof fence and have a nest protection officer in that area to protect it, to let the birds, I suppose, have a chance at hatching. But really, the risk in most cases for these birds is extremely high for predation. So for the curlew, there's a head starting program that they're running at the minute. And so that's where they take the eggs and they are sent down to Fota Wildlife Park to be incubated. They're hatched and they're reared down there in a specialist facility. And then once they're fully grown and adults, they're released back to the wild then.
We really do have to intervene to an incredibly active level to ensure their survival, don't we? So anyway, it's 4 o'clock in the morning. You're on the bog and you get a bit of a sniff of fire.
We were about 20 kilometres away from it and we could see the flames. They were quite significant and you could smell it. You could smell it on the air when the wind direction was right. So it's affected a huge area.
What do you think might be the loss of habitat and the loss of biodiversity?
Devastating
in terms of the here and now, in terms of what might be destroyed, in terms of vegetation, in terms of potential nests. We know there was curlew activity in that area. So, you know, that potentially would have displaced them and also other small ground nesting birds. You know, their nests might have been devastated and the birds themselves may have come a comeuppance to it. So there's that, the initial destruction.
Is there a possibility that rather than being populated or repopulated by heather, which the curlews like, that you could get a species like gorse ending up dominating that area, which wouldn't be good habitat for curlews and other ground nesters?
Yes, absolutely. It could be a total change in habitat to what it was before. You could also get other, you know, fire tolerant or fire resistant plants that come out back, like millennia, purple moorgrass, and those can really dominate the area where the fire has been. And if that is not managed correctly afterwards, they are then more likely to burn in future. There's very few places now where there are curlews still breeding. So to even lose one bog that, you know, even if they weren't nesting there, they may have been using it for feeding, or younger birds might be looking in years to come for a new habitat. So to lose that, lose any bit of it at all, or to have it degraded is a big blow for the curlew population in the area. As I said, there were curlew active there. There was a pair active in that area. The nest protection officer was actually due to go down there to survey it to see if they, you know, if there was a chance there was a nest there. And of course, in the fire broke out. So, you know, who's to know whether there may have been a nest there or not.
And that's just one fire on one bog in 1 week in what is looking like it could well be a record wildfire season. Clodagh Helen, thank you very much for talking to us this morning. Take care.
Thank you very much. It was great to talk to you.
So when that rain finally came and presumably made things a little bit better on the bogs in Roscommon, did you catch the smell of rain yesterday afternoon? That unmistakable, earthy, musty odour with a hint perhaps of moss that always comes after a long, dry spell? It has a name, petrichor. But why, if that rain is falling on termacadam, or bog, or grass, or trees, or on the bonnet of your car, why is that smell of rain always the same? I asked Matthew Jebb, director of the National Botanic Gardens.
I think the extraordinary thing about this is that all of us recognise the smell of freshly falling rain. It's not during a very long wet day or a wet period, but it's after a dry spell. If you've had a warm, dry spell for a week or so, and then the rain begins, there is this incredible aroma around, which everybody finds thrilling, the smell of fresh rain. The amazing thing is, if you're in South America or Tasmania or Canada or the Sahara Desert or in leafy Wexford, you will smell the same identical aroma.
Why?
Well, this puzzled people initially because they thought, there's different plants growing, there is different rocks, there's different climates. So what is this extraordinary smell? And it's been tracked down to bacteria and fungi in the soil, releasing a particular chemical known as geosmin, the smell of rock. And it's actually in soil rather than rock. It is a substance that is universally produced. Bacteria and fungi, we find them all around the globe. You know, we find certain species of bird, very restricted plants. We just find them in a continent, sometimes just in one country. But bacteria and fungi, they are so small and light. Their spores spread around the globe. So this is the explanation that whether you are in South Africa or Ireland, you will smell that same smell of freshly falling rain on after a spell of dry weather.
And whether you are in the countryside or in the city, do you get that same smell because this bacteria is windblown and ends up on all surfaces?
Yes, it's universal. It needs a soil surface rather than pure, you know, cobbled streets of asphalt and stone. But it is always there. There's always little pockets of moss and earth ready to release the smell. It is so sensitive, our noses, to geosmin. We can detect 5 parts in a trillion not just parts in a billion, but five parts in a trillion. And this sensitivity, people have speculated, is this an ability of early Homo sapiens in the African savannah to be able to sniff out water in a drought, can smell water from many miles away?
Not the smell of rock, not the smell of wet soil, the smell of wet bacteria. Not good news for germophobes. Matthew Jebb from the Botanic Gardens there. Sean Hyland in Lisnolan in County Mayo is passionate about the native Irish breeds. He keeps and he breeds the old Irish goat, Drimmen cattle, Irish moyled, Kerry cattle and Beau Rievoch cattle. Now, I was nodding wisely at that list right up until Beau Rievoch. It is a very rare and a very endangered breed. So we sent Tressa Vranach to meet with Sean and with Darren McLaughlin, the secretary of the Beau Rievoch Cattle Society.
Originally, the earliest written documentation, it says that they have stripes like a tiger. And that was written at a time when there was no such thing as like dairy cattle or beef cattle or even a breed. But we're working from whatever genetics that we can find from people that kept those cattle in Ireland. We breed up from that. So, like this one here, she's perfect. Like she's got all the stripes. She's got them on her head and down to her feet, or even her hooves have stripes.
Yes, yeah.
And she's got lovely bits of white through her as well. She's also very quiet and easy to manage.
So she is the perfect Beau Rievoch breed as regards markings, do you think?
I think so, yeah. Well, it's the most perfect one that I've produced so far.
And what kind of percentage are we looking at for her? What kind of percentage Beau Rievoch would her genes be?
Maybe 3/4. But we're genetic profiling. Darren can talk about that. The genetic testing.
One of the earliest references the society has to the Beau Rievoch is in Middle Irish, around 1,000 years ago, and it references a brindled polled cow. Darren McLaughlin from the Beau Rievoch Cattle Society tells me a little more about the historical references to the breed.
So Oscar Wilde's father, William, he was actually really interested in Irish cattle, and he references two brindle breeds, or known breeds, in the 1850s for the Royal Irish Academy, one being a brindle Kerry and the other being the now extinct Irish Longhorn. So it's possible that the Beau Rievoch shares a common ancestor with the Irish Longhorn. And we're lucky in Ireland, we have loads of above ground archaeology, and that's mostly down to superstition. But superstition actually went against the Beau Rievoch. We know that in the Farmer's Gazette in 1901, there's an article claiming that the Beau Rievoch were bad luck. And it's since then the numbers have started to slip. So it was in 2016 when the Irish Rare Breed Society did a census following Paul Flynn's initial breed characterisation that he did as part of his master's thesis. And there was less than 50 at the time. So now the national herd stands at around 150.
So that's from 2016, there was 50, and you've tripled that now to 150.
Exactly, yeah.
How did you become interested in the Beau Rievoch?
Well, I'm an archaeologist, and heritage conservation was something I was always interested in. I had a few acres. I said I'd get one cow, and then I thought, oh, she needs a friend. And next thing I bought a tractor, and I was leasing more grass, and it just sort of snowballed from there. And now I'm the secretary of the society.
Using cutting-edge DNA techniques, scientists have identified the breed signature of the Beau Rievoch and can now confirm that it is a unique breed.
The project overall has been funded by the Department of Agriculture, Fingal County Council, Leitrim Development Company, the Irish Rare Breed Society, and it's University College Dublin that's been carrying out the research.
What does this mean going forward? What do you plan to do with this scientific research and with this result?
So what we've shown is that the Beau Rievoch is the most critically endangered bovine breed in Ireland. And right now it's genetic conservation. It's the genetic conservation of heritage livestock. We want to increase the numbers and ensure that they survive.
So are you looking to open the herd book?
Yeah, so almost everything is in place to open the herd book. We're not in a big rush right now. We want to have a good selection of animals before we go that far, but definitely within the next year, and it could happen in the next few months for all that too.
You have to like it to be at it.
Do you love it?
I do, yeah. Like, some people have cattle and they complain about them, but like, I love working with livestock. Like, trying to match two animals together and you're trying to visualise what their progeny will look like in several generations down the line. It's the same with the goats and the other livestock. You're looking at two animals and you're trying to project them to produce something that you want. Mm. It could take you 2 years, it could take you 50 years. You might never get there.
And these are dual purpose cows as well, aren't they? Would you say they're commercially viable?
There's little data to say they're commercially viable, but there's no cesarean sections, no calving difficulty, no hoof trouble. They're quite an intelligent animal compared to some of the more modern breeds. They have an amazing ability to calve, lick the calve, get the calve up, get them sucking. They'll shove them around the place of their heads and then kind of push them into the hedge and hide them and then go away and mind their own business. Like, I've rarely had trouble with these breeds of cattle and calving.
To my eye, which is not a scientific eye at all, they're just a lovely looking animal.
Yeah, well, it's kind of, you're probably lucky here because you've got Irish Moyles, Drimmons and Borevox. Mm. And I don't think there's any native Irish breed more important than the other one. Like, they're all of like international and national value for genetic resources, and they're also a cultural heritage. So, I mean, everybody should be interested in preserving them, you know.
Any farmers that are listening that might be interested in getting involved in the conservation of the breed, how would they go about that?
Yes, so it's very difficult to get a cow for sale, but we are trying to develop micro herds around the country. There's less than 10 at the minute, but there is some for sale the odd time. So contact us through the website or the Facebook page is probably easiest for some people. And if you're seriously interested, we'll find you a heifer. And there's three bulls in AI at the minute, so it's doable to start a micro herd of your own, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And your daughter is here with you as well today, and you're obviously trying to conserve this breed for future generations. How important is that to you?
Well, I mean, this is living heritage and we want to see it survive for future generations. Of course, they have to have an economic value. These aren't museum pieces. They need to stand on their own 2 feet.
Stand on their own 2 feet? Not the last time I looked, Darren, but you're the expert, you tell us. You can see pictures of the Borevox on the Borevox Cattle Society Facebook page, or Sean Highland's farm is on Instagram at Liz Nolan Farm. Trasa Rannoch reporting for us there. Coming up after the break, the edible and the ornamental in leash.
Email countrywide at rte.ie. Countrywide on RTE Radio 1.
Good morning to you. Somewhere between 1:30 and 1:55. I haven't quite worked out just yet myself. 0870 32 32 32. Tim asks, is there a danger of potato blight this mild, humid weekend? The experts in this area, as always, met.ie, they have a potato blight warning system. And their advisory says, yes, there is weather that is conducive to potato blight from yesterday until midnight tonight. But it really depends on where you are in the country. The west, from Sligo to Cork, and the Midlands and parts of Wexford are all apparently high risk for the next 5 days, but do check out met.ie for their potato blight forecast. We are going to, in the meantime, return to Leash and Tongi de Toulguet of Dunmore Country School in Durrow, County Leash, has created a French potager or potager garden. A potager garden is what you call a kitchen garden if you are French. But it is still the same old mix of the edible and the ornamental. And Tongi has laid out an acre of annual, perennial and biennial flowers, mingling with herbs, fruit bushes, trees and vegetables. Anne-Marie Kelly visited them on a gorgeous spring morning.
To explain it, I have a kitchen garden divided in four, and it's divided by the organ of the plant. So I put all the root crop together, I put all the leafy crop together, I put all the fruity crop together, and I put all the flower together. Okay? So now, imagine that you have a piece broke like a cake in four, okay? Mm. A fourth, 25%, is devoted to flower.
Yes.
Flowers are very important for insects. So all the flowers, you can see them here. Mm-hmm. So that's the flower part. You can see So some would be for the bees. That's the epilobium. That's a wildflower.
Yeah.
Bladderwort. Beautiful flower coming up now. You have sweet peas. Always you will notice in my garden, you will always see something that is missing in most of the garden, legume. So you can see some broad beans.
Yes.
You can see some melilotus. So melilotus or sweet clover. So you can bruise it and smell it.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Can you smell that?
I can.
Sweet smell.
It's beautiful, yeah.
So what can you smell?
I can smell almost sweet.
Vanilla.
Yes, yeah, it's true. You know, a lot of people say, oh, we don't see your house from the road, but we like to keep it like that, you know, it's our little secret garden.
It is secret and sacred, isn't it?
It's part of himself, you know, the garden is growing with the garden and his ideas are growing with the garden as well.
How big is the, you have an acre here then, is it 1 acre?
So it's 1 acre.
Right.
You want to have a look?
Yes, I'd love to. And so you're still learning?
Yeah, I'm still learning. So I think there is no expert as such, because when you think you're an expert, don't take any in because you think you know everything.
Yeah.
So you don't listen to people on you. So, and you learn from plants as well and from nature.
How do you build up that resilience?
In terms of gardening in general, okay, the effect of the garden, you have it in your house inside. Because the first effect of what you're going to create are the colors. And the colors are going to heal your mind when you're sick. And those colors, you put them outside, you see, mm-hmm. in the garden.
So you can see them from
outside. And you can see them from outside. So the benefit of the garden, you don't have to go outside to feed it.
Yeah.
You can be inside. Then after that, I think that when you go outside, you could have the smell. And we should have the buzz of the bees and the insect. And that's part of the garden atmosphere, you know. And
because there's a meditation in that, isn't there?
It's part of it, yeah.
And they're busy. The bees are busy.
There's one honeybee there and a few little hoverflies, yeah.
And do you see then your role now as more of a teacher as well? Because you do love to pass on your information, don't you?
Yeah, I think it's very important to... A lot of people don't have my experience. I've started gardening when I was 13, 14. I had a deal with my grandfather, is that he would buy me the seeds and I would provide some veg for the summer, for the house.
That's a good deal, isn't it?
And when I was 13, 14, I would buy something like 60, 100 euro worth of seeds. And I still grow some varieties like pitsai, Japanese squash. I grew them since long, long time.
And they successfully grow here?
Yes, okay. They do, very successfully. It's... What I'm experimenting is climate change that has a huge, massive effect on food production in my garden. So I think that the only way we can kind of survive, you know, in a kitchen garden like mine, is to try different varieties to see which one would be resilient.
Yeah.
And you were talking about resilience in the garden. When I came here 30 years ago, it used to be cold, warm, dry, wet.
Yes.
It was short periods. Now it's longer spell. 3 or 4 weeks of dry, 3 or 4 weeks or even 2 months of wet. That has a huge effect on honeybees, obviously, because they need nectar. You have no nectar because the nectar is washed by the rain. It's the same thing with butterfly, with moth, with wasps. They need nectar, they don't have it. So it has a huge effect on insect, and it's globally warmer. So maybe we have crops that we can grow that we couldn't grow before, like soybean.
Yeah.
So it's not only bad. It's not, oh, climate change will be bad. No, we focus too much on plants, and that's a huge mistake. And you're right to remember that the soil is the medium that is going to, for us to grow plant. And my main focus is on soil.
Okay.
Yeah. The soil is built up by bacteria, yeast, fungi living together like we have in our guts. So if you have only one plant growing in one soil, in the soil, the microbiota is quite poor. But when you start to grow a lot of plants together, it's like if you eat a lot of food, raw food together, you're going to have a huge amount of beneficial bacteria, yeast, and fungi into that soil. So the way to mine the soil is don't dig it, protect it from the sun, UV light, and that will as well protect the water to escape. So you will save water when it's too dry. So you would use mulch.
Okay.
Mulching, grass clippings, hair, leaves, cabbage, whatever, leaves. After that, always grow crop association. You don't grow potato, but you grow potato, I grow snap pea, and I grow lettuce together.
Together?
Yeah.
And that's unusual to put those three together.
It's unusual because it was done a long time ago, and we have lost it.
Tongi de Toulguet with Anne-Marie Kelly. Somebody wants me to list off all of the plants and all of the flowers in Tongi's garden. I don't think I have the time to do that today, but more details. Dunmore Country School in Durrow, County Laois. Labour is the grease on the wheels of any farm. Time was when that labour came from within the farmer's family, but that doesn't work too well anymore. Farming would grind to a halt were it not for the skilled, mobile and flexible relief workforce in the country. But who are these men and women? What motivates them if their reward is not going to be a share in or ownership of the farm that they are working on? Farm Relief Services, or FRS Co-op as it is known, has 1,200 such operatives, and they have just surveyed them all to find out what it is that makes them tick. Neil Keane is FRS Head of Agriculture. He joins me now. Good morning. How are you?
Good morning, Philip. Thank you.
Time was you would call FRS if you wanted to get to the county final or the cousin's wedding, but it's a little bit more comprehensive now, isn't it?
Absolutely. My colleagues were still busy in Limerick and Cork last week getting relief labour onto farms there for the hurling match.
Oh, is there still a spike for the big matches?
There is, yeah, absolutely. And it's all hands on deck the week before that, getting the coordination.
Okay.
And getting
there is a more Monday to Friday or Monday to Sunday relief service as well, isn't there?
Absolutely, yeah. So, I mean, look, FRS was established back in the 70s by farmers for farmers at a time of social change in Ireland when farmers realised we need to coordinate labour more effectively and book our own time off and take time off. And the business has evolved since then. It's still farmer-owned, but, you know, today we're probably in every rural community right across the country in some guise or other. The need for labour like all sectors, has accelerated. We're in a full employment economy. And I guess within farming, we have to leverage the attributes we have that will help us attract people in.
But the motivation for so many people going to work on a farm is ultimately, I'm going to get to own or to run this place. Not so for those operatives. So what motivates them?
Some of the key motivators are that opportunity to work outdoors, working with animals, that kind of, I suppose, autonomy piece that they get when they're on the farm, that they feel that they get, particularly for people from non-farming backgrounds. Look, there's alternatives, probably higher paid jobs that could go to work in cities or towns that may involve being office based, sitting in front of screens. And I think you have to acknowledge that's not for everybody. So it's really appealing to people who are kinesthetic, like the outdoors, like being with animals and like how that makes them feel as well in their day-to-day working environment.
It can't be easy, though, being you in a full employment market and trying to find people to go to these farms. Is there a steady stream of people knocking on FRS's door?
It's a challenge. It's a challenge, but you know, we're having to be more creative in how we attract people in. And probably if we were here 50 years ago, the situation was the difficulty was finding workplaces for the surplus of workers who are available. Today we have to be more creative, and I think it's people coming from different backgrounds than previous. In the past, it probably would have been people from smaller farms who wanted to go and work on wanted to boost their income and go and work on larger farms. Now it's people maybe with a different lifestyle choice, maybe that want that flexibility, only want to do a certain number of hours per week, would like to work in their local rural community rather than having to commute to a town. So I think it's been creative in how we appeal to all segments of society.
How has the gender profile changed down the years? Are you recruiting many more women now?
Yeah, significantly more. I think last year we had 20% of our workforce is female, and that's growing year by year. And you know, I think there's an acknowledgement amongst the farming sector. We don't have the science in this, but they would say that the female operatives going on farm, the attention to detail, and probably the care factor with animals and everything seems to put them above their male counterparts.
Okay. You don't need to be from a farm to work on a farm. It probably helps. But how many people are you finding from completely non-farming backgrounds?
It's difficult to say. Probably 30%, and probably not so much from, you know, it's non-farming backgrounds, a background where maybe where they don't, the family don't own land. But yeah, we're seeing increasingly more people coming in that are coming from non-farming backgrounds, and probably coming as well with a different perspective, maybe less biases, a greater sense of curiosity about what goes on the farm, and that can bring certain positives with it as well.
Now, that's a completely leading question on my part, because it's leading to the next person that I want to talk to this morning, Áine O'Connell from Tipperary. Good morning, Áine. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Excellent. When did you give up on hairdressing and decide that it was time to go milking cows?
It's about 2 years ago now. It was kind of a spur of the moment decision. Well, I milked with my brother for a little bit while I was hairdressing and just found a love of animals and decided that's where I wanted to go next.
And was it the lure of the milking parlour, or had you found that hairdressing just wasn't for you?
It was more, I suppose, I loved animals. I've always loved animals. And with health reasons, I have really bad asthma, so it suited the outdoor, the fresh air suited me a lot better than the fumes of the hair salon.
So what are you doing now, Áine? How many cows are you milking?
Over 500 at the minute.
Good God. How much of your day does that take?
It could take 3 hours in the morning, 2.5 in the evening. It kind of depends on the day. It depends on the cows, I suppose, itself.
And do you love it as much as you did when you started 2 years ago, or is the novelty beginning to wear off?
Oh, I love it even more than I started. Even more. It's very exciting every single day.
Well, talk to me about that attraction. How is it exciting every single day? Does it not become routine?
No. I suppose I'm so used to routine in the salon that I know every client coming in every single day, whereas no day is the same on a farm. You could plan a day and nothing goes the same. It could change instantly because something else has to be sorted or some other plan comes into action. But it's a different day every day. And it's kind of exciting knowing that nothing's the same.
Do you feel different, Áine? Do you feel at a slight disadvantage to those people who are working on a farm knowing that they're going to get to inherit it and you never will? You're just going to be taking a wage from it.
Not necessarily, because I knew going into it I wasn't going to inherit the farm that I was working on. The attraction to me is dealing with animals, working with them, seeing calves being born, saving calves. I'm more attracted to the animal side of things. I have no problem with it. It's not a disadvantage to me because I'm doing what I love.
And is there a trade-off there for you, Áine? Do you actually get the flexibility of saying, okay, now because I don't run this farm, I am going to plan my holidays and I'm going to disappear, or I'm going to take a long weekend, or I'm going to go off for a fortnight or whatever?
Yeah, there is flexibility that way. I think it's a bit more flexibility than it would be in hairdressing because I'm not living on the farm that I work on. And with the workers that we have enough help that it is flexible enough that if I decide I want the long weekend or the week's holiday, there's someone there that can take over, and vice versa, if they want it, I can take over for them. So there is good flexibility that way.
You quite simply, Neil, cannot run a farm with 500 cows unless there is labour like Áine's on hand.
Absolutely. For business performance, for lifestyle, for a multitude of reasons, you need to have labour, and you need to have skilled labour coming on farm, and that reassurance that all risks are being mitigated. So, you know, to have people like Áine coming in and being prepared to learn and having that work ethic, it's absolutely crucial.
Nor, though, can you treat people like Áine like the sons and the daughters of the dairy farmers got treated. You have to, you know, be a little bit nicer.
Absolutely, and we've had a significant expansion in our dairy herd in the last 10 years, and we have amazing research and science to support a lot of the practices we do on farm. However, one of the variables in all that is people, and it's ensuring that we have the pipeline of people and that we look after the people who come onto our farms and workplaces, that we're able to implement all that best practice. So, yeah, people are absolutely crucial to the success of our industry.
Are you able to now offer people in on your situation pensions? Are you able to offer them sick pay, holiday pay? Are they going to be treated more like more routine employees than farm labourers have been before now?
That's FRS's role. So we act as that in terms of payrolling people. Yes, being acknowledging the compliance pieces of sick pay, holiday pay, PRSI, and then soon to come probably auto enrolment on pensions. So all those factors are encompassed within that process.
Anya, is this it for you? Do you see yourself milking cows and working on farm forevermore?
I think so, yeah. It's just become, it's not a job anymore. It's become just a lifestyle now. It's something that I just get up and love to do. If in the future things progress and I go further with management side or I end up owning my own farm, I'd be very lucky. But I'm extremely happy with what I'm doing at the minute. And that's all I want.
Well, very good. Continued success to you. And thank you very much for talking to us this morning, Anya and Neil. Let us return to Roscommon and a man of many parts. One part philosopher, one part student of the natural world, one part farmer. Keith Brennan, known to regular listeners, is now also, people, a librettist. Bray Choral Society in Wicklow is celebrating 40 years of singing together, and they have two concerts this weekend, and the varied programme is going to include the creation song of the Choir of Light, composed by Howard Goodall, with words by our very own farmer of many parts, Keith Brennan. Keith regularly shares his observations on life and on nature on his family farm in County Roscommon, and it is this world that inspired his words.
I have written a piece for choir. A composer, Howard Goodall, had seen and heard my writing about my life on a small, unkempt, half-wild Roscommon farm, and he thought to set some of that life and home to music. I have never done anything of the sort. To take my words and have them weaved into the sung air seemed, still seems, like a kind of magic. The piece begins on a morning on the farm. The ragged thorn hedges, the curl of wind through trees, the rising tide of birdsong that breaks over the fields. I talk to Howard, of pine martins, sapphire-eyed sparrowhawks, of farmer friends in love with cuckoos and swallows, of the leverets I find in the rushy lee of a field, the furious greening that grips the spring world, the ramshackle hedges and pastures that let slip tumbles of wildflowers from the fields that flow out and along roads and across woodlands. He talked to me of choral music, of Brexit and of culture wars, the public and private loneliness of COVID, of how community can be made by music, by song, of how we find one another when we gather to listen and to be heard. I told him of how Roscommon farmers are sometimes pagans in their hearts, quietly closer to the gods they hold dear in amongst the cuckoo calls and the flying of the swallow in their farms and fields, or so I think. We talked of how that wildness and the love of it is a shared thing. Women and men who would not call themselves poetically inclined, but for who the cuckoo call has as much or more meaning than a church bell, whose lives, farms and fields connect them to Congolese rainforests, the dust of African soil shed from swallows' plumage in Elphin, Knockvicker and Ahakilty. My small farm and its wildnesses are the work of community. The parish is crisscrossed with tree-rich family farms. Ragged hedgerows are a linear forest that thread wildness through the valley. Red squirrels bury hazels in my woods from nearby farms. My wildflower meadows are sown from the seed bank of my neighbour's lambs. The music and my simple poetry are my attempt to translate that landscape into sung sound and share it far outside this small world. Because it is beautiful, and because, as both Howard and I believe, wherever we share with one another the experience of beautiful things, the divides are blurred, the gap between people close and is bridged, and we are pulled a little closer in the sharing, and in the sharing we build community. So it is in my farm, so it is in my neighbour's fields, and so it will be, I think, when the choir sing.
Let us sing as birds in flight our song of wondrous bright, of joyous bright. Recorded earlier this week in rehearsal with conductor Frank Kelly. That is Creation Song, music by Howard Goodall, and words by our own Keith Brennan. You can hear the full piece and the full concert tonight, St Andrew's Church, Weston Row in Dublin, and tomorrow in the Church of the Holy Redeemer in Bray, County Wicklow. That is our lot. Eileen Heron conducted this choir. James Feeney sniffed out the rain. Amandine Passo Devine provided expert Breton pronunciation guides. Thank you very much, one and all. Talk to you again same time next week.
Countrywide on RTE Radio 1. Listen back on the RTE Radio Player.